This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Wednesday morning, January 5th, Rabbi David Lappin, Women's Shear.
Let the people in the of the place kill me because of Rivka. Why? Ki tovas mar'ehi, because she is beautiful. So we're told that Rivka is beautiful. Interestingly, earlier when we were first introduced to Rivka, in chapter 24, we were told not only that she was beautiful, but that she was extremely beautiful. And the Chizkuni notes that and says, so what's happened? Is she a little less beautiful than she was? And the Chizkuni says, yes, she's had a baby. which is interesting. So what is the Chizkuni saying? That there is a cost to the exquisiteness of the beauty of a woman, not that she doesn't develop a different type of beauty and grow in a different way, but the fact is that when women have had children, they're not the same as an 18 or 19 year old woman who hasn't had children. And there is a difference. She's still tovach mare. She's still beautiful enough for Yitzchak to be afraid to say, she's my wife. Because she is so attractive that in their urgency to get hold of her, they would kill her. That's how attractive she was. So when we're talking about attractiveness, we're still talking about Rivka as a very attractive woman in terms of anything that we understand. But not quite as attractive as she was. And that means that as the relationship develops and family begins to become involved and children begin to come involved, the parameters of what constitutes that attraction begins to change and expand too. So, again, no suggestion that she ceases to be attractive, but to say that she's as attractive as she was when she was a single young girl, no. There is a deterioration caused by age, there is a deterioration caused by having children. However, there is gain, there is growth, there is a maternity that comes into the beauty, there is a motherliness that comes into that beauty. And possibly what often goes wrong in a lot of marriages is that the husband doesn't evolve with that growth process. And his sense of her growing beauty in that area doesn't evolve sufficiently for him not to worry about the fact that if he looks at her through the same eyes that he looked at her 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, or 5 years ago, he's going to see something different. And if he evolves with that growth, what he sees, provided she's still looking after herself, we're not talking about a woman who lets herself get and says, well, now I'm married, I'm having children, but you can't expect me to look like anything. No, she's tovach mare. But there is a realistic recognition that it's not the same, and that it's unrealistic for the husband to expect it to be the same. It is different. And it is important for both him and her to evolve that difference, and to develop that difference, not to allow it to be a deterioration, but to allow it to be something different, a different experience of beauty rather than a decreased experience of beauty. Vayehi ki archu lo hayamim, vayehi ki archu lo sham hayamim, and it was after he had been there for a long period of time, all the time living with Sharad, that she is his sister. Vayashkeh Avimelech Melech Plishtim. And Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, not the same one at the time in Avraham, they were all called Avimelech, right? Like the Egyptian kings were called Pharaoh, the Philistine kings were called Avimelech. It's an interesting name. What does Avimelech mean?
Father of the king.
Father of the king. So that gives an idea of Philistine arrogance, that their kings were not just kings, they were the father of all kings. That was how the Avimelech saw themselves. And Avimelech was by Ashkep, Avimelech. Ashkep is what it really means is he looked through binoculars. And they didn't have binoculars or telescopes at that time. But Vayashket is, if they had, that's what he would have been looking for. And Vayashket means you look with all your energy. Sometimes you've got neighbors like that, you know. You've got that kind of Vayashket. The Adar Chalon, through the window. Through whose window? Through his window? No, through his neighbor's window. And what did he see? V'hinei Yitzchak mitzachek es Rivka ishto. And he saw Yitzchak laughing with Rivka, his wife. He was looking into the neighbor's house, not into his house. Vayikra Avimelech liYitzchak, and Avimelech called Yitzchak by Yomer, and he said, Achina Ishtachavi, she must be your wife. Vechamarta Achoisihi, and why did you tell me she's your sister? Vayomer Elav Yitzchak, and Yitzchak said to him, Yomazik ben Omos Aleha. You're right, I told you this because I was afraid that I would die as a child. I wish you were my sister. Same old story, with the nuance that he doesn't land up taking her in, and they live that way, and nobody touches Rivka, that Avimelech discovers that they're husband and wife. Vayomer Avimelech, and Avimelech then says, there's 10 mazos asisolon, and what have you done to us? Kimat shochav achad ha'omis ishtecha. Somebody, one of the people, nearly came to sleeping with your wife. They saw it in Oshon, and that would have been a terrible thing. Don't play around with these things. Who is achad ha'am? Who is this... this one, there was a Hebrew poet called Achadam. Isn't that he thought he was, that it was a very complimentary pseudonym, Achadam, and so where it comes from. One of the nation, who's the Achadam? There's Unculus, those of you who've got it, can you see it? Dim Yachad the Amma. What is Dim Yachad? What is Meyuchad? Yes, one of the special people of the nation, in other words, not the thing, just somebody in the nation, a person out here nearly slept with your wife. It's Meyuchad Shevan. Who's that? Who is the Achad Ha'am he's talking about? And how does he know that this person nearly slept with your wife?
Himself.
Sure, it's himself. Okay, what he's basically saying is, I came pretty close to it. And that wouldn't and that wouldn't have been very good for us. We know, we've had this kind of thing before. God gets angry, it's not good. And you would have brought this on us. And you would have brought sin to us. And then Abimelech instructs his people, saying, anybody who touches this man or his wife will surely die. And that's the end of the story. What we need to look at is, what did Abimelech see that made him realize that they were husband and wife? How could you be looking through the window and see that they're husband and wife? So what does Rashi say? In verse 8, Vayashkef Abimelech, and Abimelech looked and saw them laughing together. Says Rashi straight out that can mean only one thing. Ra'ahu meshamesh mitoso. He saw them making love. Otherwise, how would he know? Had brothers and sisters, so what did he see? Give her a hug, give her a kiss, what would he see? So he must have seen them in sexual relationships, and that's why he suddenly got a shock and realized this is not brothers and sisters, this is husband and wife. The difficulty with Rashi, and the Chizkuni is the one who goes into the greatest detail in the analysis of these few verses, is that the Gemara says that that's not a really nice thing to do, to have sexual relations with the windows and the curtains wide open with neighbors across the road. It's not a modest thing to be doing. And highly unlikely, in fact, it's conceivable that you'd step in front of where you'd step in, you would have done that. So how could he have been looking through the window, and what could he have seen that would have indicated to them that they're husband and wife? What do you think the Christian's answer is? He says, Lo shehaya chalon patuach. He's not suggesting that the window was open. Now in those days, their windows weren't made of glass. They didn't have glass, and they certainly didn't have commercially available glass. So what were their windows?
Open spaces.
And when you close the window, you close it with wooden shutters. That was your only. It says the Chizkuni, clearly they must have closed the shutters. And I know the shutters were locked. And then what does it say that he saw them? What did he see? It says the Chizkuni, mitoch shehaya na'u, hezin Abimelech hamas. Abimelech saw them close the shutters. That's all he had to do. And from that he was able to work. So Vayashkef doesn't mean he looked with binoculars or a telescope, because all he would have seen would have been closed shutters. Ayashkes means he looked with intelligence, he looked with interpretation. He saw the two of them go into their home and close the shutters in the middle of the day, and he realized that was what Abimelech saw, which explains his history, and this leads us into the whole discussion that I want to have today. This history also, because there's another difficulty, and that is the Gemara says that one shouldn't have sexual relationships in the daytime. There's the chizkuni, but if you close the shutters, it's okay. So the issue is not day or night. The issue is light or dark. That they should not, that one should not have relationships until daylight. And if we say, then it all makes sense. They closed the shutters, so although it was daytime, it wasn't light. And that explains why they could have been doing it, even though they crossed the street from Abimelech, and they knew that Abimelech was an inquisitive person that obviously had been watching them for a long time. He didn't all of a sudden one day decide to have a beef. Clearly that he knew that he was living with inquisitive neighbors. And why did they do it nevertheless? What brought them to do it nevertheless? The fact that shutters were closed, no problem. So how did Abimelech know that they were husband and wife if the shutters were closed? That's exactly how he knew that they were husband and wife. From their very modesty, he was able to tell that that's not something that they would have done. Other than that, that was the reason for which they closed the shutters. Before we get into the full discussion, why the word mitzachek? What did he say? What did he see them doing? So he saw the window, vayar, and he saw. And what in fact were they doing? So what did he see? So according to the chizkuni, he saw closed shutters. That's what he saw. What were they actually doing? The Torah tells us what they were actually doing. And behold, it doesn't say this is what he saw, and that's why the chizkuni works okay in the word. It doesn't say he saw Yitzchak laughing with his wife. It says, and he saw. Period. And behold, Yitzchak was laughing with his wife. So what in fact was happening behind the shutters, they were laughing. Well, what's that relevant? Why did the Torah have to tell us that they were sharing some kind of a joke? And why would they have had to close the shutters if they were sharing a joke? What's the importance of it? Says the chizkuni, and this is what Jewish girls should be taught about Yaakov. Mitzachek, tzchok shelifnei habe'ila. The laughter that precedes sexual relationships. What's he telling us? What's the Torah telling us? He's giving us the whole context of how it's supposed to be, of how husband and wife are supposed to be with one another, of the build-up, of the period before that, of the relaxation, of the lightness of being, of the softness, of the humor. That's what it's telling us about. That's part of what it is. That's what was happening behind those closed shutters. And the Torah goes out of its way to tell us that that's what was happening. And even that was behind closed doors. That there's an intimacy in that kind of softness, in that kind of laughter, in that kind of joking. A few more pieces of information. But the next one we've got to look at is the way the Unculus treats this. And the Unculus is the Aramaic translation, the first and most authentic translation of the Torah into Aramaic. Those of you, have you got the Unculus there? How does Unculus translate the word mitzachek, which means laugh? Can you work that out from the words of the Unculus on verse 8, end of verse 8? What is the word that Unculus uses for that word mitzachek? Mechayek. What does mechayek mean? Smile. Now let's try and read it. And after living there for a long time, Abimelech takes out his binoculars, his telescope, peers through the window. Let's forget about his tuning for a moment. Because obviously, Unculus is also worried about what could he have been seeing? What would they have been doing with an open window there? What could they possibly have been doing? The ladies who come late, by the way, for the shiur like this, you're obligated to listen to the tape. Because if you're not going to be able to listen to the tape, I would rather you left now. Because what's been before is so important to laying the scene for what we're discussing that you will get an extremely distorted picture if you haven't heard the first part of the shiur. I would rather you heard nothing than if you heard the second part of the shiur without the first part of the shiur. So it's important that you listen to the tape. The So Unkelus is worried about the same thing. What could he have been looking at? If they were doing anything terribly intimate, the shutters would have been closed and he would have seen nothing. So the Chizkuni dealt with that. The Chizkuni said one of the most intimate things he saw was closing the shutters. In the old days when they used to know how to make movies with subtlety, and some non-American producers still know how to do that, if they wanted to display a sexual scene, what would they show? That's all you have to show. You don't have to show any more than that. That's when you can be subtle, when subtlety hasn't been destroyed, you can leave a lot to imagination. And the imagination is usually much more wild than any erotic manifestation that any movie producer can conceive. Because whatever he puts on the screen, he only puts one possibility on the screen. And he can choose his most erotic, but it's still one. If he just leaves the doors closed and lets the audience think it out, they go crazy. And the possibilities are endless. So it's just stupid to be as explicit as the movie directors are. It ruined it. So the Chizkunis is very, very subtle, it's very, very beautiful. If you just see the scene, everybody melts and you watch it. And he sees, and he just sees Rivka, or you just walk up to the shutters and close them. It's a sort of little green house and Abimelech across the street and slam the shutters closed. And the rest is left to his imagination. And what really happens is the tale, you know, what really happened? They were giggling, they were laughing. That's what happened. The Unkelus is taking a different way and says he saw something. What could he have seen? They wouldn't have done anything intimate in front of an open window. And he's not taking the view that the windows were closed, the shutters were closed. So what could they have seen? The most that they would have allowed themselves in front of an open shutter, says Unkelus, is a smile. So he saw the smile. Now how does that fit in that they're married? The search for intimacy that takes place today and the elusiveness of that search is giving a lot of people a lot to write about and think about and counsel about. But it's something quite weird. One has to say, what has gone wrong and why is there this crazy search for intimacy and why are people not finding it? Whether they're in relationships, whether they're out of relationships, why is it there? And one of the reasons I would suggest is that intimacy needs instruments. It needs certain techniques. The moment a technique of intimacy is used for non-intimate purposes, it ceases to be an instrument for intimacy. So if, for example, you only shook hands with somebody who you were intimate with, then a handshake would be an expression of intimacy. If you shake hands with everybody but you only hug people you're intimacy, then a hug would be an expression of intimacy. If you use a person's surname, unless you are intimate with him, and you use his first name when you're intimate with him, then his first name would be an expression of intimacy. But in our society, we have used up all the instruments of intimacy on non-intimate relationships. So there is, in fact, nothing left to be intimate with. And even in intimate relationships, there is nothing to show intimacy with. Absolutely nothing. If you take a look at wider society, there's absolutely nothing left to show intimacy with. In their society, a smile was something you reserved for intimacy. A particular type of smile was something you reserved for intimacy. He could see by the way they smiled at each other that they must be husband and wife, because that was the level of intimacy that society associated with that particular instrument of communication. And as society has developed, if one calls it development, so we have begun to use more and more. And America is probably the biggest culprit of all, where there is no way you can know. If you're sitting in an airplane listening to two people talking in the seats in front of you, you cannot know if these are lifelong friends of extreme intimacy or whether they've just met on the plane for the first time. As a foreigner, I cannot tell. They had exactly the same conversation within minutes. So first name terms talking about not only their wives and children, but their affairs and illegitimate children. And you don't know whether that's because they're going to disappear from one another in 2 minutes' time, or whether they really are very close. And then I used to think, when I used to lie to China, this is intriguing. You know, how is it that everybody in this plane is intimate except me? Everybody seems to know each other except me. I don't know anybody in this plane, and everybody else is having these intimate conversations. So I started feeling a little bit out of it. I kept on listening, doing it, Abimelech. And then at the end of it, I really got lonely when they used to say to each other when I was in American Airlines, at the end of it, everybody would say, see you later. And I was thinking, gee, these people really all know each other. They're all going to see each other later. They've established relationships, they've networked, they've exchanged phone numbers. They're all going to see each other later. Nobody said to me, see you later. until people started saying to me, see you later, and I never saw them again. So I realized what it is. See you later is an expression of friendship, but not in America. See you later is a way of saying goodbye. A first name term is an expression of allowing a certain amount of intimacy, but not in America. A first name term is a way, for anybody, it makes absolutely no difference. So what have we left for intimacy? Even sex is no longer reserved for intimacy. It's a form of self-expression, and it's a form of pleasure, and it's a form of all sorts of things. So when a husband and wife finally get together, what do they do together that neither of them have ever done before with anybody else in our society? Nothing. And then they spend the rest of their life searching for intimacy, because they do not have any intimacy. They are the intimacy, that's intimacy. Whereas in their society, non-intimate relationships were distant. And if an American looks at a European and he says they're so cold, they're so cold when they don't know each other, so that they can be so warm when they do know each other. Americans, I'm not being anti-American, just talking about our society here, and this is driving not just American society, it's driving a lot of other societies today too, because of the media. But American society, they are so warm when they don't know each other, resulting in the fact that they are so cold when they do. Cold, not that they're less cold than when they don't, but that's not satisfying. To be as warm with somebody you're close to as you are with somebody you've never met before means you're being cold with the person you know. It doesn't help that you'll call him first name, you'll call him darling, you'll put your arms around him, you'll kiss him, you'll go to bed with him. It doesn't make any difference. At the end of the day, it doesn't satisfy the need for intimacy, because there's nothing reserved for this relationship. There's nothing that is exclusive about this relationship. There's nothing that is only in this relationship. And so the search for intimacy continues pursued. And of course it's meant to be there. It's not meant to be there. If you look at Unkelus, both of these, Kuni and Unkelus, are so beautiful in their description of the society, where a smile meant intimacy, where a close of the shutter meant intimacy. And that's all anybody was going to see, because anything else was reserved for intimacy, and only took place amidst intimacy. And that gives us one element of the Torah's new dimension. One of the elements, or one of the dimensions of tzniut, is the preservation of the maximum amount of gesture for intimate relationships. And we're not just talking about husband and wife and the rest of the world. There's a spectrum of intimacy. But as you get closer to a person, you're allowing more and more instruments of intimacy to be used in that relationship, so as to differentiate them from other relationships. So you will be more exuberant with some person you know than somebody you don't. You will be on the first name terms. There are different levels of intimacy, and it's not only in the intersexual relationships, it's obviously in the relationships of the same sex as well. Exactly the same applies, that need for some level of intimacy. And I don't even know whether in exploring this, I haven't given enough thought to put it out as a thought out theory, but whether it certainly needs to be thought about whether this doesn't have something to do with the spread of homosexuality today. And that heterosexual sex is so common that intimacy is being found in same sex relationships. Which is a new experience. I've never done this with anybody before, so at least we can be close friends. Whether there isn't some level of more exclusivity, and also because of the secrecy that needed to be there, that it wasn't possible to find more internal expression, more privacy in the homosexual relationship than in the heterosexual relationship. That it was something more behind doors, it was something more closed, something more, and therefore there was a greater ability to find intimacy in those relationships than in heterosexual relationships, which have become so public and open and ordinary. If that theory is right, then recently. So the test would be whether that ceases to be
always.
Okay, but not open.
Anything earlier was
made.
I mean, the spread of AIDS was
hastened. Maybe there's no connection to that at all. Now, what this leads me to, though, is to the Gemaras that caused so much distortion, so much trouble. I'm going to read one of these Gemaras to you in the second chapter of the Gemara. Gemara says the following. Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Dehavai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Dehavai said the following. Dalad Torim Tachuli Malachi Hasharis. The angels whispered four things to me. Told me four secrets. And he shares them with us. Chigrim mitnei ma'havim. Why are there lame people in the world? Mitnei shehosim eshulchono. Because husbands and wives have sexual relationships in positions other than the conventional one. One thing. Ilmim, why are there dumb people in the world? Mitnei ma'havim, why? Mitnei shemenashkim alosu makum. Because husband and wives engage in oral sex. Number two. Haroshim mitnei ma'havim, mitnei ma'havim. Why are there deaf people? Because they talk while they're making love. No unusual sexual positions, no oral sex, and no communication, no verbal communication. Sumim mitnei ma'havim. Blind people, why are they? Because people look at each other in their private places. So that's that. So what goes on to a discussion? Now this opens up the whole question of, it's all very well saying that intimacy is reserved for the husband-wife relationship. But what in the husband and wife relationship? Are there major restrictions there too? And the Gemara says, we're saying yes. So the Gemara is not too happy about this and asks, Shalu et ima sholem, they ask ima sholem, certain women, how come all your children are so gorgeous? What's your secret? What's your recipe? Every one of them, just one more beautiful than the rest. How do you do it? Amra lahen, she said to them, my husband and I, when we have relations, she uses the word mesater, which means converse. So without the twist, we converse with each other, we engage in conversation. We don't do it early in the evening, not early in the morning, but right in the dead of night. That's when we do it. And she says, I asked him once, why is it we always do it like that? And he said so that while he's engaging in the build-up to our relationship and in our relationship, that I'm not thinking of anybody else. Early hours of the evening and early hours of the morning, there are voices outside, there are people outside, my mind starts wandering, middle of the night, I'm alone with you, being with you for several hours, maybe hours before I go out into the world again, I can focus on you, and that focus exclusively on you is what is responsible for the quality of our truth. Anyway, the reason the Gemara brings it's an interesting thought altogether, that the fact that only at that time could he focus completely on her is quite interesting. That he felt that that was important for the quality of children they have is interesting. But that's what's really interesting is they talked. So that's what the Gemara says. You've just said that you have blind, you have deaf children from communicating verbally during intimate moments. And here she is saying that's in fact how we have such beautiful children. Onto the Gemara, Habamili the Tashmish, Habamili after the night, but you're right. There is a contradiction here, and how do we resolve the contradiction? Of course you can talk and should talk, but you should talk about sex. Not about business, and not about the children, and not about the price of groceries, and not about the budget. That's what it means. So there should be no conversing on anything other than erotic issues. This is tomorrow. Not later on, this is tomorrow. That's how it resolves it. But now comes the interesting part. That piece of tomorrow that I've learned for you, most yeshiva bochurim know. And most girls from friends know. But for some reason they stop there. They don't go to the next line. Listen to the next line. And this Gemara, by the way, is brought in the halacha, in Orachah, in the first section of Shulchan Aruch, which they also know. Second line, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, Zu divrei Yochanan ben Dehavai. Yes, Yochanan ben Dehavai said this. Let me just say, Rabbi Yochanan ben Dehavai. Yeah, he just calls him Yochanan ben Dehavai. When it was introduced, it was Rabbi Yochanan ben Dehavai. Interesting, isn't it? Rabbi Yochanan ben Dehavai says, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Says Rabbi Yochanan, the great Rabbi Yochanan. That's Yochanan ben Dehavai, without using his title. Well, Amru Chachomim, but the rest of the rabbinical world tells, Ein halacha ki Yochanan ben Dehavai. The law is not like Yochanan ben Dehavai. Ela kol mashi odam roitze la first to ishto oisa. Do whatever you want with your wife. There are no limits. That line they don't learn.
And the Gemara goes on to say, and so why do you go out from the Mashal? This can be compared to the Basar Hamadi Beis Ateva. Meat comes from the butcher. Rotzel Oslo, the Melach Oslo, Sli Oslo, the Bushel Oslo, Sholot Oslo. You want the salt, you put salt on. You want it roasted, you roast it. You want it boiled, you boil it. This is how you want. The laws of kashrut determine what meat you can get from the butcher. The laws of kashrut do not determine what it should taste like and how you cook it and how you prepare it and how you serve it. You use your imagination for that. And so the laws of the Torah determine who you may marry and who you may not marry. The laws of the Torah do not determine what you do in bed when you marry. That you use your imagination for. But this they're not taught in religious schools. The same dog, the same fish. You don't have to buy, you don't have to buy, have meat, you can have fish. There's no law that must be this type of woman or that type of woman. If you like fish, it's fish. If you like chicken, it's chicken. If you like meat, it's meat. Take what you want as long as it's kosher. There is a wide range of kosher women that you can have. And once you have got them, you can do as you please. Provided, by the way, it's consensual. The halakha is very clear on that. You can't do as you please against the will. The Gemara then goes on to say that somebody came before, a woman came to Rebbe, a great Rebbe, the author of the Mishnah. A woman came with a shayla. Rebbe, arachti li shulchan v'hofchoi. The way she puts it is very cute. She says, Rebbe, I have a shayla for you. I laid the table and he turned it over. Amra lo, she said, what does Rebbe answer? Biti, Torah hitilcho v'ani ma'aseela. The Torah allowed you to him. What must I do? Forbid you? Torah didn't place restrictions, but I impose restrictions on your marital relationship. What are you coming to me for? This is between you and him. Now, this is also brought past in the halacha. So we have in Shulchan Aruch, but this comes in Evan Ezer, much later on, the path that they don't learn. Evan Ezer, who learns Evan Ezer? People are becoming rabbis and need to know the laws of marriage. But boys in yeshiva learn Arachayim, they're in the first part. And the first part brings the first part of the Gemara and does not bring the second. The second part is brought in the laws of marriage. The third part is brought in the laws of tzniut. Now how can they both be brought in the halacha? Why are they both brought in the Gemara? What's it all about? What's interesting is, who gave Rabbi Yochanan ben Dehavai these secrets? Angels. Okay. So we need to realize, and what is the Gemara saying? That's angels. That we're human. Now, what does that mean? If the angels gave those secrets, it means there's something in it. If we were angels. If we were functioning on a purely spiritual level, then that might be the way we would function. Our sexual relationship would be spiritualized to the point of being almost non-sensual. That we are not. We are sensual beings, and therefore it is it's not spiritualized to that effect. And that leads us to an understanding that there are laws of tzniut that are absolute, and there are laws of tzniut that are relative. And there are laws of tzniut that apply to everybody, and there are laws, and then there's a whole spectrum of tzniut where a person can opt where, or a couple can opt where on that spectrum they wish to be. But in terms of halachic permissiveness, provided the partners are halachically permissible, what they do with one another is halachically wide open. There is a concept of tzniut, and they can make their choice where to be on that spectrum. But they better be sure that where they've chosen to be is a place that satisfies them. So if they're operating on a high spiritual level, it might be that they are sexually satisfied with less sensuality than somebody who's operating on a lower spiritual level. But the most dangerous thing of all is to think you're operating on a high spiritual level and act that way when you're really acting on a lower spiritual level. That's like going on to a refined kind of diet, which your own body is not ready for just because some super gymnastic person is able to function on that diet. That doesn't mean that you're able to function on that diet. You have to do what's right for you, and that's what the Gemara is saying. You have to do as a couple what's right for you, not the most extreme example of angelic behavior, because we're not angels, we're human beings, and we have human needs that need to be satisfied within that relationship. So, bearing in mind that Gemara, when Unkelus says he saw them smiling, when the Chizkuni says it's the laughter prior to the sexual relationship that the shutters were closed, and that whole issue of darkness is an interesting one, which is also that part of that intermission, we've spoken before about that in the whole area of tzniut, is that part of that intimacy and part of that tzniut is that once, well, the visual is a problematic sense, because once you've seen everything, the imagination stops. And a very important part of the sexual relationship is imagination. And therefore, yes, the visual is an important part of that, and that's why there are laws of tzniut in the first place. But if a woman exposes herself totally and absolutely in broad daylight, there's not much left. And that the ability to know, even in dimmed light, there is an opportunity for imagination. And it's interesting that in nearly all societies, romance is associated with dimmed light. There is an understanding that clear, strong light doesn't do a lot for a relationship. Because the more you, not a question of the more you see, there's a point at which you've seen it all. And when you've seen it all, there's nothing more to find, there's nothing more to see. And once that happens, the imagination is finished, and a lot of that, the dynamics of that relationship is finished. And not so with the sense of touch. The sense of touch is a sense that allows and encourages imagination. And as little children know, that playing with the sense of touch in the darkness is the most imaginative game they can possibly play. That's why they blindfold themselves, that's why they turn off the lights, and they feel around them, and they imagine all sorts of things. Your imagination goes wild when you can touch but you can't see. When you neither touch nor see, you don't imagine, you're paralyzed. But when you can explore with your hands, but there's a limit to what you can see, the clarity of your vision, that allows imagination in fact to be stimulated. And a lot of the laws of tzniut in the intimate relationship are designed to protect the survival of the imagination in that relationship. Now what's interesting is that they lived in a society that was so subtle that Avimelech knew from the smile or the closed chakra, whichever way we want to take, exactly what was happening, and wouldn't touch her. Realize they're married, and therefore, hands off. What is Yitzchak afraid of? Why didn't Yitzchak just say she's my wife and then they wouldn't touch them? What does the Torah tell us? He'll be killed. He's afraid that he would be killed. Actually, he would be killed. How does it work in the animal world? If one male elephant wants a female elephant that belongs to another male elephant, what does he do?
Fight.
He fights. They fight. And what do the females think about that? They love it. Right? They love it. For them, that's an important part of the whole of the whole thing. To see the males fighting over them and the strongest male winning. And there's an evolutionary element of that, obviously, that the strongest in the species is the one that wins. But there's also a whole kind of animal social thing. So in the laws of the jungle, that's how they operate, and they operate that way in primitive societies. In some of the black African societies from where we come, that's the norm. It's quite okay to have a passionate fight with another man, two men to have a passionate fight over a woman, and to kill one of them. And the woman then switches allegiance, and she's quite proud. My man killed my husband for me. Okay, that's how much he loves me. It's actually okay. And as children, those of us who grew up in South Africa used to remember the terrible fights that used to go on in the servants' quarters in the houses there. But as children, I remember that being quite terrifying. And they were always over a woman. And this was part of that society. So this is a primitiveness, which in that society, in that society was okay. It was a primitiveness that in fact enhanced the way that they lived together. I want to just briefly finish this, just part of the same thing with our friend Asaph, who comes back into focus. He comes back into focus in verse 34, chapter 26, same chapter, verse 34, where we're told, Vayehi Asaph ben Arboim Shana, Asaph was 40 years old, Vayikach Isho, and he married a woman, Es Yehudis Vasta Eli Hachiti, Es Bosmat Vasta Eli Hachiti. He married Yehudis, the daughter of Ba'eri, and Bosmat, the daughter of Elon. Now, two wives, age 40. So the Rashi on that, Esav hayamim shal l'chadis. Esav was a chadis. Esav was a pig. Now, why say that here? Well, at his wedding day, is that a time to say Esav is a pig? 40 years old, he gets married, they should say mazel tov. Hachazir hazeh, kshu shochev, when a chazir lies down, toishet shalofel, he puts his paws out, very far forward, he lies out with his legs stretched up. And I know some people don't like showing their children pigs, but how would Russia know this if he didn't see how pigs lie down? One should take one's children and show them cow, what a pig looks like, how it operates, why the Torah doesn't like them, and why the Torah doesn't like us to eat them, the way they behave, the way they eat, the way they roll around in the mud, and the way they sleep. And the way they sleep is with their paws like stretched out. Well, what's so terrible about that? Look how the cloven hoofs, he's saying. His hoofs are very prominently out, and he does have cloven hoofs. So he's saying, I'm kosher. Because there are two signs of kosherus in an animal. What are they? Cloven hoofs. Chewing the cud. External and internal. One you can see, one you can't see, one you have to be a scientist to know whether this is an animal that chews the cud or not. Cloven hoofs. Any child can see whether it's cloven hoofs. So kosherus is, what is the Torah telling us? Kashrut depends on an alignment between an external manifestation and an internal manifestation, which is not visible to the public at all. The pig has the external and none of the internal. And that's what a chazar is. A chazar is a person that displays his Yiddishkeit and has nothing inside. Definition of chazar. That's the chazar that the Torah tells us to trace. When the Torah says, trace, thou shalt not eat it. That means thou shalt not consume, thou shalt not take in from the chazar. Learning a little bit with one of our kids while we were away, and we noticed that Rashi sometimes, with the Rashi that we were doing, sometimes uses the word kosher and sometimes uses the word mukta, in fact. Mukta is things you can't catch on Shabbos in relationship to people. And we were discussing that a mukta person is a person that you can't come here. But don't even associate with those people. Let's keep away. A non-kosher person is a person you can associate with, just don't eat him. Don't take in from him. Don't absorb his ideas. And then you've got a person who's kosher. A pig of a person is the kind of person that Torah says, don't take anything in of him. Why? He's the person with all the external manifestations and with nothing internal. If you study him, you don't find it. You don't find the kosher. People like this. Gozlim b'chomsim, they steal and they plunder. U'marim atman k'sherim, that they eat kosher. Those are the ones. So what is the chazal? The chazal is the person whose business relationships are dishonest. That's klap kosher. That's the chazal. That's not a from Jew. That's the chazal. Those Rashi, unbelievable Rashi. And that was Eitha. Wow. Again, this is Rashi's wedding speech for Eitha. For 40 years, Esav used to hunt women from under their husbands and oppress them. Kishayor ben Mem Amar, when he got 40, he said, Abba ben Mem Shalom Asa Isha Afaniten. In our family's tradition, Yitzchak, my father, he got married at 40. 40, I'll get married as well. Come on, Esav, you just wanted 40 years to play the field. That's why you got married at 40. That duplicity was something that Rashi is turning as the is calling the chazar in Esav. But what's interesting in Esav is how does Esav satisfy the competitive element of his character? There is a competitiveness in man. We've been learning that in the Kuzari Shia. There is a competitiveness in man, in the male particularly, that is very fundamental, very primitive, and there. He thrives on competitiveness. And that competitiveness is not only in business, the competitiveness is in every area of his life, including the social and sexual. So in the animal world and the primitive person world, we've seen how it works. They fight each other for their women. And if necessary, kill each other for their women. What does Esav do? How does Esav compete with competitors? He steals the women. He seduces them. He steals other people's wives. It's interesting that in a society that abhors aggression, what happens to male competitiveness? How does it manifest itself? In deceit and theft. But it must be that way because he satisfies himself when he takes something away from somebody else. Now, there are two ways you can do that. Either you hammer the other person into submission and you can take it, or you do it deviously and say, ha, I fell. You didn't even notice. But both of them satisfy that drive in a human being. In the Esav and the Philistine societies, we're looking at two very opposite societies. The Philistine society, highly aggressive, where the competitiveness manifested itself in male aggression, but not in male deceitfulness. They wouldn't touch a woman who they'd seen smiling with a man and therefore connected with that man. There's some Jewish defense. We settle our differences across the table. What about your competitive spirit? Deceitful. And of course, our Western society, what is it? Is Esav or Plishtim? Esav. we're living in, you know, we're coming to South Africa, we're living in a very, in a society that's very foreign to us, both of these, Palestine and Israel, but we're living in an Arab society. Aggression, murder, it's a terrible thing, violence, it's the worst thing you can do, death sentence. There's other ways of doing it that you can work something out. That's okay, that's how competitiveness manifests itself. And people talk about the difference between aggression and assertiveness. But assertiveness only works if you have power. If you have power, you can afford to be assertive. If you don't have power and you are being manipulated by somebody else, you have to be aggressive or deceitful. What is our society? How does our competitiveness manifest? Where does our competitiveness get expression? In our society, the poor men aren't allowed to kill for their women, nor are they allowed to steal women. So where does their competitiveness? What is their competitive outlook? And in business the same. They can't kill in business and they can't steal in business. Where's the competitive? What do they do with the competitive spirit? What does competing mean in business in our terms? It's all very well talking about competition in the current environment. There's no competition in today's environment. The economy is so robust that in fact there is no competition today. Everybody's busy enough. The time to look at competition is in recession and see how they treat each other in recession. Then you see competition. And what do they do in recession? They kill. They kill. And what we're saying is that when we talk about America as a free market, forget it, in the sense of talking about it now. This is not a true manifestation about the American way of business. It is an outcome, possibly, of American business, and very healthy and wonderful. But the test of morality in business is when there's a limited amount available and two people are struggling to get the same client, the same customer. How do the two treat each other in the pursuit of that customer? Do they kill each other or do they steal?
Like 5 years ago, and layoffs right and left.
But there wasn't recession. There was layoffs, but there wasn't recession. Look in the 70s. Look in the 70s. Carter's day. That kind of recession.
5 years ago,
there was a recession.
What was the inflation?
I think 8%, 9%. Yeah, South Africa's 40%. Think about the 70s. Think about the 70s.
Yeah.
Remember the 70s
yeah.
When people were shooting each other at petrol pumps. Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about. I need that gas, and there's only a little bit left. And if you're in front of me in the line, I will kill you.
Yeah, but I think we're saying the same thing. We're saying that in business, in the United States, people will compete.
So, compete is a funny word. Compete is a word that could mean very gentlemanly, and could mean very underhandedly. What does compete mean? Ruthlessly compete. So ruthless competition is, are there two ways? The Philistine way or the Arab way? Either you steal or you plunder. Either you steal or you kill. What is the Jewish way of competition is what I'm really asking. How do we satisfy our needs to compete? And how do we satisfy in a free market system, which is a Jewish system? And how do we satisfy it socially if we can't use the Philistine route and we can't use the Esav route? What is the Jewish route? Who do we compete with? Where do we satisfy? Where does the male ego get satisfied? I think that's right. I think there are two things that we compete with. I think we compete with ourselves. What does the Mishnah say? Ezer the giver, who is a powerful person. Who's the Jewish giver, the Jewish hero? Kovashis Yisrael. Beat your strongest competitor. Yes. But for that, you've got to be strong. When your own self is diminished, there's no fun competing against yourself. When you're a nothing, your ego is not boosted by beating yourself down some more. When you're powerful, and you have energy, and you have an urge, and you're bright, and there's a part of you that is able to dominate all of that and direct it the way you want it to be directed. The Jewish competitive spirit is satisfied in the conflict between man and man, within man himself. What happens to Jews who compete the Philistine or the Esav way? Especially that they might lose, but sometimes not. There's something worse that happens to them. What happens to the Jew?
Sometimes he becomes like them. No.
Something worse than that. He needs psychiatric help. He becomes complex. He becomes, because he is given these two powerful forces. God says, I'm giving you the ability to enjoy all the competition you want within yourself. Now you go and you're busy competing on the sports field, and you're busy competing out of business and killing people and stealing from people. But inside yourself, there are two forces clashing against one another that are not being managed. So what's happening internally while you're busy running around doing the kind of thing that brings satisfaction to non-Jews? But they don't necessarily satisfy the competitive drive of the Jew. So he remains all messed up inside, unsatisfied by his need to compete, because he's competing with a competition that he wasn't designed for. He was designed for a different level of competition. And finally, the second competitor. So the one competitor is yourself. Who's the other competitor that you compete against? God. And that's compete is the wrong word, that you engage, you challenge, you deal with. That's the study of Torah, where you challenge God intellectually. What greater sense of competition is there, of satisfaction is there, than taking a godly concept, challenging it, questioning it, attacking it, and mastering it, coming out of clear understanding. So in the intellectual level, it's in the grappling with Torah. In the emotional level, it's grappling with oneself, if one is powerful enough to enjoy that grapple. And that means the other one doesn't have to compete destructively with one's environment in order to satisfy one's own fulfillment. Then one may engage more constructively with one's environment. And that's a long discussion all on its own, which perhaps we'll see a little bit further.